live from the NBC News radio broadcasting studios of KCAA, 1050 AM, 102.3 and 106.5 in beautiful sunny California. Hope everybody can hear us. We're having a little miscommunication here with the microphone. We got it going in there, Nick. Well, again, live from NBC News radio broadcasting studios of KCAA, 1050 AM, 102.3 FM and 106.5 FM. Located in beautiful sunny California, where it's almost 70 degrees today. It's beautiful. Appreciate it. I'm Rob Starr, along with the best man in the industry, Mr. Chris Davey.
Hey, how are you doing, Rob? I can hear you just fine. That could be because I'm sitting 2 feet from you. But
oh, I didn't hear you before, and you didn't hear me before.
I didn't, right? At the beginning, I didn't hear you.
Oh, we're good? We're good to
yep,
go?
We're good.
Nick says we're good to go.
Yeah, he's got the thumbs up. Oh, wait, is that a Yeah.
Is that
good.
A thumb? Yeah. Looked like a thumb to me. Hey, for those of you who are listening, I just want to let you know we've expanded our media platform. So if you really want to listen to us, you can. And if you want to even watch us, and we'll give you a wave. We're now on NBC News Radio, KCAA Radio, as I just mentioned, the three stations, Talk 102.3 FM, Express 106.5 FM, Amazon Echo, Facebook, Instagram, iHeartRadio, Spotify, Stitcher, TuneIn, iTunes, Spreaker, Tiki Live, Pandora, Podbean, YouTube, TalkStream Live, KCAAradio.com, NBCNewsRadio.com, and Ustream.
That's a lot of places.
And we're getting bigger and bigger and bigger. We appreciate that. And for anybody who wants to call in, please do so. We have some great guests, as always. And if you want to call us, the number is 888-909-1050. If you happen to be local in this area, you can call 909-792-5222. And those are a lot of medias. I didn't realize how big we're getting.
No, it's great, right? I mean, part of the affiliation with NBC News Radio is we get this sort of exposure and coverage, and we believe that the content we bring is important, and obviously it's resounded because our listener base is growing.
Absolutely. Right. You know, it was interesting. I was, I was out of town. I think our listeners know also. I was in Cleveland, Ohio with Weiland, the well-known marine artist, kicking off the 2019 Mayor's Challenge for Water Conservation.
I hope you had fun out there. Well, you left me at home to do all the work, but that's
I'm no. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. But it was great. We were actually our NBC affiliate, Channel 4 News, out in Cleveland, and also Fox covered it, and a UHF channel covered it, along with the newspapers and such, and had a bunch of people there for speeches, and it was great.
I wonder how many people know what a USH channel is. UFH channel.
UHF.
UHF.
Ultra high frequency. Well, those you have a tinfoil hat and you can listen to the
stand in the corner.
Stand in the corner.
Left arm up.
No, but it was great. And, they had the mayor, they had the chief sustainability person for the city of Cleveland. Weiland actually painted not today, but 25 years ago, he painted one of his 100 mural walls. And so he's coming back in June to retouch it up because it was there 25 years, and it was good. We had a couple hundred kids. It was at the Davis Maritime and Aeronautical School, Technical School, and also they have a digital art school as well, which I think is really neat because kids now in high school can learn stuff and get a jump start on a trade. Instead of maybe they're not cut out for college, but it was
no.
It was
I'm a good. Huge proponent of trade schools, yep. Big time.
So anyway, the NBC News is going to send me a link to the video and audio of what we did there, so we can play that in the next couple of weeks. We will have the mayor of Cleveland on the radio, as well as the chief sustainability engineer on that. So that's great. Anyway, I'm excited to be back. I'm tired, but it was good. 5 hour flight. Long flight. My arms hurt. But
I just flew in from Cleveland, and boy, do my arms hurt.
Yeah. Again, we'll keep our day job. Sorry about that.
Ba-doom-tsh.
Yeah. Anyway, we have two great guests on today, and one is our standardized guest who we love tremendously, and it is Miss Chris Maven Austin from Maven's Notebook. Chris, hi.
How you doing, guys?
We're good. We're crazy today. I'm just looped because I'm tired. Didn't get much sleep. But 3 days of nonstop meetings and press and everything else. It was incredible. So,
well, we've had a big week in water news. I mean, probably, I don't know, it's hard to figure out what is the biggest story, but I think I would have to probably give it to the water going down the newly rebuilt spillway at Oroville
Yes,
Dam.
Yeah,
yes.
Big deal, yeah. All the major stations carried that story.
Oh, yeah, and it was big on my blog, too. I have some partners up in the North Valley that actually caught some of the first video and got it out on the Internet before the Department of Water Resources. So it was actually hot news. Great. It's performing as it was designed to do, and, it's always an awesome thing.
Well, you know, instead of, you know, the governor is trying to add a bill or something for $10 for every home to pay for the cleanup water in Central California, why don't they make a slide attraction out of that? At the spillway,
yeah,
and charge $10 a ride down. I mean, that would be great. They raise a lot of money.
You know, at the bottom of that spillway, they have these dissipators because you don't want to dump this large amount of water straight into a riverbed. It's going to carve a big hole, right?
Yeah.
So they have these big blocks at the bottom, and I mean, when you look at it from afar, it doesn't look so big, but like, when they were going through and working on reconstructing them, like, people are little ants, like, to those big blocks.
Right.
It's like, you're just nothing to that. I mean, it's a tremendous amount of water that goes down there. And they're only running this at right now at just the bare minimum. But, I mean, that spillway is designed to take down that 10 times the amount of flow, which actually happened back in that February when the spillway failed. We were getting hit with all these multiple atmospheric rivers, and they were pushing so much water down there, which it was designed to do, but it had this flaw and there came the hole. So, you know, that was 2 years ago, February. It's been rebuilt now. So That's all great. It's going down there.
Well, that's a good thing. Hey, you know, speaking of coming down in slides, did you see about 6 months ago they opened a slide on top of this giant building in Los Angeles? I think it's on their 50-something or 40th floor.
Oh, my word. My husband and I, we did that.
Oh, did you?
You did that?
Awesome, Chris.
Well, I should specify. I do not go out on no slide that's out like 60 floors down. Sorry, no. But my husband did. He's a brave soul that he is. He went down it. It's like, it's only about maybe like one story or a one and a half story. I mean, but the thing is, it's plexiglass. And when you get in there and you go down, like, you're actually over the street, which is like, 64.
Wow.
Well, it's like,
I still see an opportunity for Six Flags up there in Oroville Dam. The first ride they open will be called Dodge the Dissipator.
Yeah.
Good luck with that.
Yeah, win a bunny rabbit if you miss it out. So I hear about the California water fix that Metropolitan Board Workshop compares one tunnel options to Cal Water fix.
Oh, yeah, I posted that this afternoon because I meant to get it up on Wednesday, and I didn't, and I didn't get it up this morning, so, and Friday's a dead day, so, yeah. The Governor Newsom said in his State of the State address that he supports, he doesn't support the water fix as it's currently configured. He supports a one-tunnel option. And, of course, he has not said what that one tunnel option is. And I say, well, it could be one tunnel for 15,000 CFS.
Yeah.
He didn't say smaller tunnel now, did he? But, so we're all kind of waiting to see. But, in anticipation of that, Metropolitan Water District held a workshop for their board of directors to talk about what the capacities of a smaller one-tunnel system would be.
Right.
And, it's less water and less benefits in terms of, environmental benefits and reversing, in terms of stopping the reverse flows that happen in the Delta, which sucks the fish into the pumps.
Right.
And I mean, this all really remains to be seen, because the governor really hasn't given anything much more than just saying a one tunnel option. But what does that one tunnel look like?
Right.
I mean, we don't know. So we're all getting to play guessing games at this point.
When do you think this whole project will start and get, and when do you think it'll finish?
Well, you know, the thing about switching to a one-tunnel option is, I don't know, I'm thinking it's going to be hard to see how they could proceed without having to redo environmental documents.
Oh.
And when you have to redo environmental documents, I mean, you can do what's called a supplemental environmental document, but that supplemental is sort of like, so you've made a few revisions to your project, and so you have some changes. I think taking water fix from two tunnels to one tunnel is quite a major change, and I don't think it can, you know, it. But who am I? Okay, first of all, I'm not a lawyer, and I'm not a specialist in this, but my money would be on that would be a major change that would require an entire new environmental document, which means we've got a few more years ahead of us to see if it happens, if then.
In your knowledge, could you maybe guesstimate what do those reports cost?
Oh, gosh. You know, it would be at least a couple hundred thousand dollars.
Or that's it, or it would be into the millions or something?
Well, I mean, they've paid, I think, so far for the Bay Delta, I mean, for all of this planning process, which has been going on for 10 years, I think it's like $260 million. But, you know, that's for 10 years of process where the project has gone through multitudes of changes, and they didn't even get to the environmental documents. That sort of came at the end.
Yeah.
And so that is only just a portion of the $260 million.
Yeah, I'm just thinking of the expenses that the California taxpayers have to put up.
Oh, but actually it's not the taxpayers. You know, who's paying for this are the water users, in a sense that, you know, all of our water districts in metropolitan and those that would receive water have been putting up the funds for the environmental documents.
Yeah, but they get it from people
thing.
Like us. They pass they pass on the cost to us.
Well, yeah.
So, in a sense, yeah. I was just saying, I mean, it's just a lot of money we keep spending.
Yeah, but it's not a taxpayer expense. That's a ratepayer expense.
Okay.
As a ratepayer receiving that water, I mean, your water district needs to be able to go out and figure out what they need to do to the water system
to keep
delivering water to you. So, I mean, it's a justifiable charge. And, you know, spread across, you know, the entire Southern California area, it's minimal.
No, I understand it. My only point is that we're paying more than one time for something. And you know, and they can drag it out for, like you said, 5-10 years or whatever. But
well, it's not – your water agency doesn't want to draw it out for 5 or 10 years. They build it now if they could, trust me. I think it's just getting through all of the processes. And you could say that, yeah, there's a lot of red tape, but, you know, it is good that we stop and we take a look and we consider the ramifications of the changes that we make to the environment.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's like, yeah, I know that when, you know, people just want to always go and build something, but sometimes that's, you know, there can be problems with doing that. And when people stop and take a look and talk to each other, sometimes you can actually come out with a better project, because maybe other people get involved, maybe there's other needs, they all get wrapped up. So, you know, I'm not one to say that, you know, going through this environmental process is bad. You know, it's time consuming, yeah. And, yeah, there's an expense to it. But there's also an expense to building something wrong. and having to go back and fix the problem for it afterwards.
True. Well, that's why we read your stuff and we talk to you every week, because you're the one who has more knowledge than we do about this. So we appreciate it. And yes, I'll ask you those kind of questions. But again, you're the person in the know more than anybody. And I'll tell our listeners, if you really want to know about what's going on in water in California, go to mavensnotebook.com, because this lady is it. She knows more than anybody, even in the government. Yeah, you do. Seriously. I mean, I ask these questions all the time, because, again, I'm just a guy in the know. I don't read. I should read everything every day, but I don't. And I just see California spending money on a whole bunch of stuff. And, you know, I guess it doesn't get conveyed very well. You do a great job in explaining that to people like me and our listeners. Mm-hmm. You know, half the time when you read the newspapers, and it depends what newspaper you read, you get a different side of the story. So it's confusing.
And sometimes they're just wrong.
Yes.
I think we're served pretty well by the coverage that we get.
Sure.
In the L.A. Times here and in other and other major media outlets around the state, it's generally some of the smaller, more offbeat ones where, you know, the reporters maybe didn't quite capture all the word I like to use is texture.
You know,
all these California water problems have a lot of texture. They're not as easy as you might think they are right at the outset, you know.
Well, I noticed this, Chris, this week on your post, two wetlands-related stories in there, right? I mean, I know first we've got some easing of the protections from the Trump administration, so that led, I think, California to adopt a few new wetlands protection policies.
To be honest, and actually, if you dug back on it, I mean, this is one of the things where the reporters sort of paint it that way. But really, the process has been underway for about 10 years at the State Water Board to get to this point with the regulations. It just so happens that they are getting to this point at the same time when the Trump administration is relaxing them.
Yeah, so
it sort of seems like it's in response, but the truth is that it's been 10 years in the process.
Yeah, so the question is this really rooted in a change, or is this business as usual that just happened to coincide with an announcement that was made?
Well, it kind of coincided, but this is something, like I said, it's been 10 years in the making, and there's been a lot of public input. It hasn't gotten a lot of press coverage because it's sort of a wonkish sort of issue, but they had a Supreme Court decision back, I think, I don't know, about 10 years ago that sort of left some wetlands issues, and they call it this dredge and fill, but if you're filling in an area around the coast or around a water body that is sort of wet and species depend on it, they kind of, you know, they don't want to lose any more of those wetlands. And there was a Supreme Court decision that sort of came down that left what people in the state of California felt left some opening for bad things to happen, shall we say. So they started this process to define our own stricter standards for waters of the state and wetlands and when you can, you know, dredge things and, you know, dump your sediment here and there. It's all to protect wetlands. And, you know, there's the Obama administration put out a Waters of the United States rule that was the federal version of this. And people, you know, there were those that loved it, but like the farmers and a lot of development people hated it, and they felt it was too strict.
Right.
And so Trump came in, and now he's relaxed that and taking a sort of the other direction. But California's had this other thing going on for a while, and they finally did adopt it with a lot of public input. So we'll see how it goes. Yeah. The interesting thing is that, you know, the federal government doesn't necessarily have to comply with state standards. So, you know, we'll see how this goes going forward. I think there's a lot of friction beginning between the state and the feds in terms of water management because the Trump administration has some different views on how things should go. And, you know, the Bureau of Reclamation has kind of said, you know, well, they said when the State Water Board adopted the new flow standards for the San Joaquin River, the Bureau of Reclamation said, well, we're not so sure we're going to go along with all of that. And now they've gone and they filed a lawsuit against those very water regulations. So there's, you know, we're just California water policy and federal water policy seem to be coming to a head.
Yeah, I think that friction hits a little harder in California than in a lot of other places, right? Because we're so vehement about it. In the past, in the history of California, there was, you know, 10 years ago or before all this stuff started, there was, you know, dredge and fill operations that went on, kind of, you know, nobody kind of looked really hard. But the other story, I said there were two, so the other story was the story of how science has looked at rebuilt wetlands, especially in the southeast and the Florida coast, having better results to restore wetlands versus build a wall to prevent the erosion in the first place. I thought that was extremely interesting.
Oh, and this is such a big, it's especially a big issue on the Louisiana coast. I mean, I think they say they learn, I read somewhere that they lose a football field, you know, of land a day because they've dammed the rivers, you know, the Mississippi River, which flows into there, so the sediment doesn't come in, so the land doesn't get built. And what this means, you know, the big thing about wetlands and sea level rise is that they really provide a buffer, especially to, you know, the bigger waves, and especially for hurricanes when they come in. You know, those big waves come in, and if they hit a seawall in a city, then, you know, they're battling against the seawall. But, you know, New Orleans used to have this big, long marsh up until you got to it, right? So when the big waves came in, they got attenuated or, you know, toned down by this gradual, you know, land that was there that's no longer there. And they're really trying to figure out how to implement this in the San Francisco Bay. You know, there's a lot of shoreline development all around the San Francisco Bay, and they're trying to, you know, figure out where they can build wetlands and make places for the water to come. It's going to be a difficult adjustment.
Yeah, a great subject and a lot to cover on that. But I think, Rob, we're probably getting to a commercial break here.
Absolutely. So, Chris, we want to thank you for coming on and giving us the straight stuff every week because we need people like you.
Okay, well, thank you. It's my pleasure.
And everybody go to mavensnotebook.com. You can go there every day. What's the best time of the day to go to get the latest and greatest?
Water news.
No, I know, but what time of day?
What time of day? At 9 a.m. I'm posted up by 9 a.m.
Okay, that's what we want everybody to know. So,
and you can sign up for emails and get it in your email box.
Yep,
so look on
right.
the sidebar for that.
Absolutely. Right. And if anybody wants to help sponsor that, please do so. There's a little link to that, and we highly recommend it. As I said, she's the number one person I know for water news.
Mavensnotebook.com.
All right. Thanks, Chris. We'll talk to you next week.
Okay, take care.
Have a great week.
We're going to be back in a minute. We're just going to go to a couple commercials, and we'll bring in our next guest all the way from back east in Milwaukee. So stay tuned.
KCAA Loma Linda, 1050 AM, K292 FQ Riverside, and K293 CF Moreno Valley.
If you knew there was a pipe cement that works better than the one you're currently using, is better for you and the environment, and costs the same or less, would you buy it? Well, no-brainer, right? Weldon, the trusted leader in solvent cements for over 60 years, is pleased to introduce a new line of solvent cements that does all that. Introducing the Eco Series line of solvent cements for PVC piping systems. Not only does it work great and set fast, it also has 30% lower solvent emissions and less smelly fumes. A better workplace environment when you're installing pipes. But don't just take our word for it. EcoSeries products are the only solvent cements that are Green Seal certified for environmental innovation for effective performance, improved working conditions, and for use with potable water. Now available in a medium-bodied fat-setting blue formula, 905 Eco, and a regular-bodied fat-setting clear formula, 900 Eco. Pick up a can today from your local distributor and see, smell, and feel the difference, just like Joe Sweat, president of Sunrise Irrigation, did. He said, after using Weldon's 905 Eco, we immediately noticed the application was smooth and there was noticeably less odor than other blue solvent cements on the market. The guys love it. To learn more about Eco solvent cements from Weldon, visit the website at www.weldon.com or call the technical service hotline at 877-477-8327. That's 877-477-8327.
Time to take a water break and talk some water. Irrigation. Such a refreshing topic. As more and more markets face water restrictions, your customers may be hungry, or should I say thirsty, for water-saving products. For new installations, add options like drip irrigation, controllers that respond to weather data, pressure-regulating heads, or heads with check valves. They all provide easy ways to differentiate your bids and win more jobs. Or for an extra stream of revenue, offer existing customers upgrades like high-efficiency nozzles, rotary nozzles, or Wi-Fi-based controllers. Because when you help your customers save water, you make a world of difference for the earth and your bottom line at the same time. We'll drink to that.
Alrighty, welcome back to the second half of the Water Zone Show with Rob and Chris, and we're having a great day today.
We are indeed, Rob.
It's been a long week for us, and but we're still here struggling, and we'll make it happen.
Absolutely.
We got the fire in the belly and the passion, right?
We got it going.
We got it going. Okay, we have another guest that we've been excited about having on for a long time, and we finally snagged him all the way, and we do appreciate because he's a couple hours, I believe 3 hours difference than us, so we certainly appreciate this next gentleman being on, and we will send you something for being on our show today. We appreciate it. A gentleman named Matthew Howard, he's the Vice President of Water Stewardship for the Water Council in Greater Milwaukee, and he's also the Director of Alliance for Water Stewardship in North America, so we'd like to bring this gentleman on and give him a chance to say hi. Hi, Matt.
Hi, how's everybody doing?
We're okay, Matt. Thanks. Appreciate it.
I was just kind of...
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Oh, you're welcome. I was just kind of near you this a couple of days out in Cleveland. Just got back this morning, so it was cold back there.
There's a rumor. I can't confirm this rumor, but I hear that spring is around the corner, so we'll see.
We went out to dinner on... was Monday night, and it was the opener for the Cleveland Indians, and I guess they had a day game, but the whole streets were filled with people like at 8 o'clock at night. Had to wait a long time to get on for dinner. But anyway, can you tell us a little about yourself and how you got into the water business?
Yeah, sure. It's kind of a winding story, but my background is actually in economics, and I spent quite a bit of time working as an economist for the federal government in D.C., and ended up getting into some sustainable manufacturing issues with the U.S. Department of Commerce and was looking at ways that manufacturers in the U.S. were using energy and water and other natural resources in their direct operations and supply chains, and really wanted to get more involved kind of at the street level, if you will, on sustainability issues, and ended up taking a job as the sustainability officer for the mayor for the city of Milwaukee. And we really spent a lot of time in that job focusing on water issues. And in particular, our water issue in the Great Lakes really revolves around better management of stormwater. Mm-hmm. And so really our issue is a water quality issue. So it's how do we keep polluted stormwater runoff out of Lake Michigan and the Great Lakes tributaries. So got really involved in water from a management perspective, from a municipal perspective, and As it turns out, the Water Council is headquartered in Milwaukee, and I got to know them through my work with the city. And a position became available in this partnership with the Alliance for Water Stewardship, and I jumped at it. And it's been great because it obviously marries a passion that I have in my career around sustainability and water, but also in my personal life. You know, I spent a lot of time outdoors fishing. That's one of the things that we're getting ready for here in Milwaukee is we're waiting for the steelhead and the salmon to run off Lake Michigan and go up the tributaries for their spring runs. And so we're eagerly anticipating the day when we can get out into the rivers and start doing some fly fishing for some steelhead. So it's been a great career for me because I get to sort of marry the two passions together.
That sounds good. When I was in Cleveland, they were talking about, if I'm pronouncing this correctly, the Cuyahoga River. I guess that caught on fire 50 years ago, and they cleaned it up, and now they're having lots of fish in it that you can eat now.
Yeah, it's a vibrant fishery now.
Yeah, so it's supposed to be pretty cool over there. So we've had people on, Dean Amhouse from the Water Council and other people, and Mary and such. But we understand that you recently spoke about what's called a different kind of blue wave on the horizon. And maybe you can relate that to what your work is and what you're doing.
Yeah, sure. So, you know, I think one of the conversations right now that businesses and corporations are starting to have, not only in the United States, but certainly internationally, is really focusing around water and how water impacts their supply chain and what that means in terms of risk and managing risk from a corporate perspective. And so when we're talking about, you know, a different kind of a blue wave on the horizon, it's really the rising recognition from businesses and others and their stakeholders like investors that, you know, we really need to start focusing on addressing water risk in those supply chains, whether it's a quantity issue, if you're in California, for instance, and water scarcity is a problem that you're dealing with in Southern California, or again, if it's a water quality issue and you're an agricultural producer in the Great Lakes, and that's a major issue up here in my neck of the woods. And so that blue wave is really just this increasing recognition amongst businesses that we really need to get more serious about addressing water and really kind of tackle it in the same way that businesses and corporations have done around energy and waste, you know, over the past 15, 20 years. So I think kind of water right now in terms of how businesses are thinking about that issue is very similar to how businesses were thinking about, say, energy efficiency 15, 20 years ago.
Matt, do you think, this is Chris, Matt, do you think there's a general competency throughout the country, Milwaukee especially, and even here in California, of an understanding of the true value of water? You know, do people really understand what the true value of water is? Do you see that as impacting part of the decision-making you guys and the Alliance for Water Stewardship has to make?
It's a great question. I'll be honest, unfortunately, I don't see enough businesses and organizations really putting the true value into water. I think part of the problem with that statement around, you know, what is the value of water is oftentimes we just concentrate on what is the cost to procure water and how much does our drinking water cost and how much does it cost us to send it back down that pipe and into the sewage system. And so because of how successful our modern infrastructure is in the United States, our drinking water and sewage infrastructure, you know, really all we're paying for when we purchase water, we're really just paying for the energy that it costs to clean the water and then to move it around. And so it's an unnaturally low cost, so to speak, for water. And so I think sometimes people conflate the low cost with its value. But if you look at situations, again, anywhere in the United States, there's been a number of smaller communities, and certainly there's been some tragedies like Flint, where you've had municipalities lose water service. And if you would ask any individual, any business in any of those municipalities what they would pay that day to get water service back, right, it would be a huge amount of money. So we've had this mismatch right now in our minds between how much we're paying for water, but what its true value is for us. And one of the things we like to say in Milwaukee, because I think we're known for beer and cheese, you know, without water, there's no beer, there's no cheese, right? So it's an existential issue, and it's it's really been an interesting learning experience for me, just having these conversations with companies and businesses about, okay, what is the true value of water for your organization? I mean, you can't make your products without water. So we're just trying to get that mindset to kind of move beyond just viewing water as an input that we manage, that we move quickly through our facilities or across our farm field and kind of down the pipe or back into the waterway, and really begin looking at water as an asset that we should be stewarding. And when we take that asset mind frame, then we look at not only the direct costs associated with procuring water, but a lot of the indirect costs that are associated with water, whether that's brand image or regulatory management and compliance. And we begin taking a more comprehensive approach to how we're treating that resource.
I think there's needs to be even more education. I mean, the water agencies, at least that I've seen around the country, have done a good job. But, you know, still the majority of people think you just turn the faucet on and water comes out, and they think, well, it's going to rain another day, so more water is going to come. But they don't realize that that water that they're drinking today was here millions of years ago. It's the same water being used over and over and over and over through various processes. And I noticed when I was in Cleveland, and the same thing with Milwaukee, there's lots of cropping up these craft breweries. Something Chris probably knows more than that about it than I do. He likes craft beer, right?
I know nothing about beer.
but I noticed that there's a lot of these boutique breweries that are now using recycled water to make their beer. The same I've seen with Coca-Cola and Pepsi, where they're doing the same thing to use water more wisely and more efficiently, and by, you know, using the recycled water. Is that becoming a popular thing in Milwaukee for some of the breweries there?
Yeah, so we've definitely seen a huge growth in the amount of microbreweries in the upper Midwest, and including in Milwaukee. We haven't seen a lot of recycling or reuse in the brewing process per se, but what we've seen from brewers as well as others in the food and beverage sector is water that's fit for use. So how can we recycle water to a certain extent so that maybe we can use it for cleaning, for instance? Mm-hmm. And so there are some regulations, some food and drug related regulations from the federal government that prohibit different types of water reuses in food production. But we're seeing a lot of different types of manufacturers, even outside food and beverage, recycling water fit to purpose, using it for cleaning, et cetera. And so that movement is certainly well underway throughout the United States. But yeah, it's interesting that you talk about the fact, you know, the water that we have on our planet, it's been here for millions and millions of years, right? And so it's constantly being recycled in this closed loop system. But we as humans have this psychological issue or this barrier where we want the water to go away, to be cleaned, and then to live in a lake somewhere or underground in an aquifer, and then we'll pull it back up again in, you know, 50 or 100 years, and somehow it's magically different than if we were to actually just send it through a recycling process. And so that's been actually somewhat of a harder issue to address from the drinking water side. I know there's a couple of utilities in Texas and in California where they're essentially doing toilet to tap recycling at the municipal level.
Right.
And that was a really big, you know, sort of issue to try and win over, you know, citizens to kind of get behind that.
Yep.
But I mean, that's all we're doing though in the long run, right, with our water. So, but it has been interesting to see that evolution of recycling in the manufacturing sector.
Yeah, I would be fooling our listeners, Matt, if they all know, as our long-term listeners, that I like wine, but I love beer. So there's a brewery out here that makes an IPA, and the P in the middle of IPA is spelled with two E's behind it, because it's made with recycled, reclaimed water. So I know some of that's going on, so I haven't tried it myself, personally.
Are you afraid to try it?
I am afraid to try it.
Well, you know, in Orange County here in California, they have, as Matt said, the recycling plant, and they did the toilet to tap. And a lot of people don't like to say that word
right. In
our industry, but that's the truth. And they give tours, and then at the end of the tour, they give the water out. And it'd be surprising how many people try it versus how many people don't try it. Mm-hmm. And they can't believe that it's going to be any good or it's bad. But, you know, the if you think about it, the people who go, the astronauts, All that water that they're drinking in that space capsule, the space station, it's all recycled right there.
Yeah. Yeah.
People don't realize that. Yeah. I mean, the value of water is just super important. What do you see as the top key factors relating to water today? So any global risk to society, you know, so forth and so forth?
Yeah, I think it kind of ties into our kind of previous conversation about the value of water. I think the biggest risk, and now I'm going to really speak more from the perspective of a business, you know, a corporation,
right.
That this many corporations simply do not understand how they're using water and the risks that are associated with where they're sourcing water from. So a lot of the conversations, I'll give you a for instance, a lot of the conversations that I have with companies, and again, in particular with some food and beverage companies, is really working with them to better understand where they're sourcing water from, whether that's directly from a municipality or it's groundwater, they have wells, they're directly sourcing from a surface water body, et cetera. Once you understand where you're getting your water from, there are some risks that are just inherent to that. And it doesn't matter where you're at in the United States, whether you're in the desert or, again, whether you're in, you know, the northeast part of the United States. And so if you're getting water from a utility, for instance, there are risks that are associated with increasing rates. Infrastructure needs to be replaced. New plants need to be built or updated. And, of course, those costs are spread amongst the rate base, and that includes businesses. So there's just inherent costs as it relates to the rates that you're paying. Then there are, of course, risks that are associated with the actual bodies of water that either the utility is sourcing from or where the company itself is directly sourcing. And again, you need to have an understanding of the quality and quantity related issues that are associated with those water bodies. So I'll use Lake Michigan as a for instance. I can almost see it from my house. It's about three blocks from where I'm talking to you from here tonight. And yes, it represents 20% of the world's freshwater reserves, but there are some legacy pollution issues with the Great Lakes, in particular mercury and PCBs. And there's also issues, water quality-related issues associated with agricultural runoff. And in our neck of the woods, it's really a phosphorus issue, phosphorus-loading mm-hmm. issue. And so if you're reliant on high-quality water, say you've got sensitive metallurgy processes happening inside your metal bending, you know, manufacturing facility or your forge, and you need very precise water quality on any given minute over the course of the day, well, that can fluctuate depending on sort of what contaminants have gotten into that drinking water. And so just understanding, again, where you're sourcing your water from can help you mitigate some of those risks. And we do have a number of manufacturers in the upper Midwest, particularly where we have lead pipes, and the municipalities add phosphoric acid to the drinking water to offset, you know, the effects of having lead pipes. But that phosphorus makes it into the facility. And if you've got very sensitive processes and you need to keep your phosphorus levels, you know, within a certain range, the amount of phosphorus actually fluctuates over the course of the day. And so we have many manufacturing facilities that need almost real-time water quality monitoring and sensors. Now, that's a completely different issue than if you're in Southern California and you're sourcing water from another part of the state or another state or a combination of all of the above, and you've had a bad year with snowpack, for instance, say a couple of years ago, and then understanding, you know, are there going to be conservation measures that are going to be put in place? You know, how is this going to impact the way my stakeholders are viewing how I'm using water in the midst of a drought or some other sort of extreme weather event? And so, again, it's really just having conversations with companies to help them contextualize, you know, how they use water and then the risks that are associated with that. And again, it's really hard to get them to right. many companies to think seriously about that because the cost is so artificially low.
Right.
So I think that's the biggest challenge, just really trying to understand where am I getting water from and what are the risks that are associated with that.
You know, unlike the telecommunications industry where hundred years ago Ma Bell buried all this copper wire so everybody could have landline phones, and now that's all going to cellular above ground, you don't need that. But, you know, the whole country, if you take a look at the infrastructure of the pipes to carry the water, they're 100 years old in some places or more. And that all needs to be changed because of the lead and everything else and breakage and things. You know, that's going to be a big, big task for America to do. And the cost is going to be staggering for all of that. But if we don't do that, then you have a risk of having contaminated water and people are going to get sick and you're going to have lots of other issues for that. How do you see, I know you and I talked briefly on some questions back and forth, but how do you see that affecting the U.S. because of all this old infrastructure and the cost to fix it and replace it?
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to be an alarmist, but it's a looming crisis, quite frankly. Yeah. And, you know, where does the money come from, right? There's so many competing priorities right now for, you know, federal and state tax dollars. And then, you know, how do you allocate enough to really replace the infrastructure that has really now and probably surpassed its useful life, right?
Right.
And so, again, you're looking at kind of increasing rates. So you're going to have to raise rates because you're going to have to pay for that replacement or improvement of that infrastructure. But I think one of the things that companies can do, because companies are, clearly can't solve the public infrastructure issue, right? They're going to be impacted by it. But I think one of the things that companies can do, particularly, again, if they are water intensive, is have a conversation with your utility and try and get a sense of what is the replacement schedule for your area. What is the status of the public infrastructure that's coming into your private property? That's another conversation that has been really interesting for me, again, to have with corporations. Because they don't really think about that infrastructure until, of course, you know, a water main breaks or until there's
right.
a problem. And, you know, let's stay on top of those issues. Again, you know, that company may not be able to solve and replace, you know, of course, public infrastructure. But again, at least understanding if there are some short to medium term problems that could arise because of how old that infrastructure is.
Right.
I spent some time, I think I mentioned at the beginning, some time out in Washington, D.C., the beginning of my career. And I was always fascinated when there was a water main break or a replacement of a lateral, and they dig down and they pull up either a wooden pipe or a pipe, you know, made out of essentially out of bricks, right?
Yeah.
And so there's a lot of really old infrastructure out there. And again, this may be more of a eastern half of the United States issue in terms of the extreme age of the infrastructure, but I think it was the American Society of Civil Engineers graded, you know, U.S. water infrastructure as like a D or a D minus or something like that a couple of years ago. And the scale in terms of the dollar amount to replace that, I think, was in the trillions of dollars. So
yeah,
we're really talking.
No, I was going to say, you just, you know, as you mentioned, they dug up one spot. Can you imagine if they had to dig up that whole lateral line, which is probably miles?
Exactly. Yeah. And it's expensive. It can be up to $1 million a mile, you know, to replace a water line.
That's a high price line. You may be encouraged by this, Matt. I have some colleagues and friends who do strategic planning for other companies, and because of our association, our discussions and roundtables and stuff that I've been at, these guys are beginning to see, or telling me they're beginning to see more companies look at the challenges they face as it relates to water, right, or the lack of water and their future needs for it. So it may be encouraging to see at some boardrooms this becoming a topic of discussion.
Oh, certainly. And I think that there's kind of two areas of interest, if you will, from two different types of stakeholders that the corporations are starting to feel the heat in terms of how they're addressing water. One set of stakeholders are essentially customers and people that are interested in how that company is using water and how their products are being made. And they're starting to ask questions about, you know, how much water is in this bottle of soda, et cetera, and where is that water coming from, and, you know, what does that mean for our community if you're using water to make this product? That's one type of pressure that the businesses are really starting to face from stakeholders. The other is investors. And so we're starting to see more companies, especially public companies that are reporting to the SEC. You know, they have an obligation, a legal obligation, to report on all risks that are material to their operations. And we're starting to see more and more companies now in those SEC filings putting in water as a material risk, because it is. and then that's really spurring action on behalf of the company across the enterprise to really begin dealing with that water use issue. And I can't give you a specific example yet today of a company that was denied access to capital or the cost of capital was increased because they weren't transparent about how they were addressing water risk or they were a bad actor as it relates to water. But those days are right around the corner. I think they're going to be here quicker than we assume. And again, especially in the food and beverage sector where, you know, I mean, water is the business, right?
Right.
And without water, we don't have those food and beverage products.
True. Hey, I understand you guys have the Alliance for Water Stewardship has some standards that you've developed and distribute. And maybe it's like a sixth step. Am I correct in that? Or?
Yeah, actually, you were correct. We just changed it. It's now five steps.
So okay.
We just made it easier. Yes, you're exactly right. We have a standard, the Alliance for Water Stewardship Standard. We just call it the AWS standard for short. And it is the only standard of its kind in the world, basically, that helps companies deal with all their water-related risk issues, whether that's physical risk associated with quality and quantity issues or regulatory risk, financial risk, even, again, that reputational risk from consumers and other stakeholders. So the standard is really a process that a company puts in place to help them identify and prioritize risks that they're facing at a factory or at a farm, and then put a plan in place to mitigate those risks. So it's not a, as we say in the business, a prescriptive standard. It doesn't come in and tell, you know, a company thou shalt do X, Y, and Z. What it says is follow our five steps in this standard, and we'll help you through that five-step process identify and mitigate the most pertinent water-related risks that you're facing as a company. So it's really, the standard itself has only been out to the public and widely available since 2014. And we're in our second version. We just launched version 2 of our standard on World Water Day on March 22nd. And that's when we went from the six steps to the five steps. So it's hot off the presses. But it's a very user-friendly standard, and it's flexible, again, for companies, whether they're in California or they're in Wisconsin. The standard is all about following the process, prioritizing your risks, and then putting a plan in place to mitigate those risks. So it's a really great standard. And again, there is no other standard like it on the planet as comprehensive that addresses water issues.
So this can go out to anybody across America?
Definitely. And in fact, one of the things that the Alliance for Water Stewardship has done is we've made the standard free to use and download.
That's awesome.
So there's not too many... standards out there that are like that. So we just want to get it out there. We want people to start using it. And it's going to do two things for our business. And I think oftentimes in our conversations in this country, we pit these two things against each other, but they're not mutually exclusive. And this standard will help you both be more competitive and improve your bottom line, and it'll help you improve freshwater resources. So I think that's a great thing.
What current industries are using this?
So, as I mentioned, food and beverage has been the first mover with our standard, but we're starting to get into some really interesting sectors right now globally and in particular here in North America. So petrochemical is really starting to use the standard. Pharmaceutical companies are looking at it now and using it. I had some really interesting conversations the past couple of weeks with consumer product companies, and we've even gotten into microelectronics and IT, in particular in some companies based in Silicon Valley that you've probably heard of, Apple and Google are
oh, absolutely. Water is critical for them. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, yeah. So it's been really great to see it expand beyond food and beverage and now getting some really new and interesting sectors.
That's
how can people find out more, Matt? Is there a website they can go to?
Yeah, where can they get a hold of you or your organization?
Yeah, for sure. So you can check out the Alliance for Water Stewardship in North America at awsnorthamerica.com.